From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how regular meetings between police and community leaders have helped ease potential tensions.
It boils down to having conversation, being able to sit in the same room with people that you are going to have to agree to just disagree at times.
Plus, new life for independent bookstores in Michigan.
I think that we are refashioning ourselves one more time to assist and adapt to the customer who is looking for an experience with books.
An Ann Arbor filmmaker tells stories of the people who still live around the Fukushima nuclear plant after the worst nuclear accident since 1986.
There are people who decided to stay there, and they told me they have been trying so hard to rebuild their life.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Unrest between police departments and the communities they're supposed to protect, it's happening across the country. But here in Michigan, regular meetings among police, community leaders, and civil rights groups are building bridges.
You know, because you want a segment of each of the different groups there. You know, you want the law enforcement folks there. You want the political folks there. You want the faith-based people there. You want the community watch people there, the neighborhood association people there, the business people there. You want everybody there that's going to come into contact with law enforcement, which quite honestly is everybody.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, opening lines of communication in Michigan before it's too late. But first, the Michigan Attorney General's office has decided to withdraw subpoenas sent to reporters who are investigating prison conditions for teenaged inmates. The AG's office served subpoenas yesterday against a Huffington Post reporter and then against Michigan Radio. The subpoenas asked for all notes and records dealing with interviews connected to a lawsuit that alleges sexual assaults against teenage state prison inmates. Huffington Post reporter Dana Liebelson said she was served twice last week while she was on assignment in Michigan. Yesterday, Michigan Radio received a subpoena asking for information connected to attorney Deborah LaBelle's appearance last week here on Stateside. Well, after quite a bit of media coverage yesterday, an AG's office spokeswoman said they decided to withdraw the subpoenas and pursue the information, quote, in other ways. Robin Herman is general counsel for the Michigan Press Association, and she joins me now. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you, Cynthia. Nice to talk with you.
How common is it, Robin, for reporters to be subpoenas about not so much about who their sources are, but is in this case a subpoena seeking the reporter's notes or audio of interviews?
It's relatively rare to have such subpoenas issued, and especially rare to have them issued by the AG's office or a prosecutor's office. Where I see them more frequently is in private civil litigation, not involving a government entity. But even then, it's fairly rare.
So when you got this news yesterday and heard about these subpoenas being served, how surprised were you?
I was quite surprised, actually, both with the fact that there had been subpoenas issued and with the particular factual circumstances of how the subpoenas were served.
What do you mean by that?
Well, as I understand it, the Huffington Post reporter was served with a subpoena while she was at the prison and conducting an interview or shortly around that time period. And typically that's not how subpoenas are served on someone.
Now, you've already told us this is very, very rare. And I'm wondering, what are the legal standards? How does this all fit in with First Amendment protections?
Well, reporters have a First Amendment right to gather news as part of their the freedom of the press. And depending on where the reporters are, there are either statutory protections in addition to the constitutional protections or case law protections. And what that means generally is that the news gathering process is protected unless there's a compelling reason that the information is needed. And especially protected are reporters' notes, their confidential informants, and anything that is not published. The standards are slightly different if the information is already publicly available, but the highest protections are for confidential sources and for information that is unpublished.
And just to kind of give us some First Amendment 101, Robin, why is that so crucial?
Well, it's critical because the public's right to know depends on the press's ability to gather the news, to investigate the news. And the courts have long recognized that if reporters are faced with subpoenas that require them to turn over information obtained from confidential informants or otherwise unpublished information, it can negatively affect what the public eventually knows, because it harms the news gathering process, which means that the reporting process is also harmed.
So circling back to what you had said about your surprise that the likes of an attorney general whose job would be protecting the Constitution would send these subpoenas down the road, that's why you were so surprised.
Yes, I think so. One of the other things, Cynthia, is there's something called an investigative subpoena that prosecutors and law enforcement officials can use, and there's been some decisions relating to that. And when I first heard, I wasn't sure whether or not an investigative subpoena had been used or a more standard sort of subpoena that we see in civil litigation. And it turns out that it was not an investigative subpoena, so far as I could tell.
In the investigative subpoena, that would be, give us an example, just so we understand how that works.
So the case really, if you remember the riots at MSU in, I think, approximately 2000, mm-hmm. there were criminal investigations relating to that. And a bunch of news entities received subpoenas to get unpublished information, right? Film footage and witness statements, that sort of thing, as part of the investigation. And the statute in Michigan and the case law says that investigative subpoenas cannot be used for this sort of unpublished information, especially when the reporter is not the person who's the target of the investigation. So when I first heard about this, I was concerned that perhaps an investigative subpoena was used, which would have been inappropriate so far as I can determine in these circumstances, but it wasn't.
Robin, what's your sense? Why do you think Attorney General Schuette's office decided to withdraw the subpoenas?
That would be speculation, certainly, on my part. I think that in my experience, and this doesn't include the Attorney General's office, sometimes lawyers just automatically send out subpoenas because it's an easy way, in their view, to get information from others. It's, if you've seen the form, it's relatively simple to fill out, and they don't necessarily think through who they're sending the subpoenas to and the fact that they might be getting information that is subject to protection.
As general counsel for the Michigan Press Association, I can imagine you've spent some time kind of weighing this in your mind. I'm wondering what you think this says about the relationship between journalists and the government. Is there a deeper takeaway here?
That's a tough question. You're always concerned as a media lawyer with the government respecting the importance of the press reporting on the functioning of government. It's critical to the democratic process. And sometimes, whether it's deliberate or inadvertently, the government can suggest that that role of the press isn't respected. I don't know that that's what happened here, but it's important for government to function well, for the press to report on when the government is functioning well and when the government isn't functioning so well. And so I think that role of the press really needs to be respected by the government.
Robin Herman is general counsel for the Michigan Press Association. Robin, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Cynthia.
And here's the Attorney General's full statement regarding this subpoena. Quote, in doing the department's job of defending the state of Michigan from lawsuits, a civil service attorney followed a common legal procedure of subpoenaing information from individuals entering Michigan prisons to speak to prisoners who are suing state taxpayers. However, after further review, Attorney General Schuette has determined that information necessary to defending the state of Michigan can be obtained in other ways and will direct department attorneys to withdraw the subpoenas, unquote. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 4 years ago tomorrow, a magnitude 9 earthquake hit the coast of Japan. It triggered a tsunami that left over 15,000 people dead, and it caused nuclear accidents, mainly the meltdowns at 3 reactors in the Fukushima nuclear power plant complex. Hundreds of thousands of residents were evacuated from the area, making this the largest nuclear incident since the 1986 disaster at Chernobyl. Ann Arbor-based filmmaker Toko Shiki has just made her first full-length film, Threshold: Whispers of Fukushima. Toko Shiki, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What stories did you want to tell us through this film?
People's life. Actual people's life in Fukushima. What's going on? What's really going on over there? Many of us, like, kind of probably imagine about the Fukushima equal radioactive pollution or problem or those kind of negative side of the stories. But some students in Fukushima actually told me Fukushima is not just a radioactive pollution or problems, but there are people who decided to live here.
Who stay put. And we here get so much of the knowledge about this whole story from mass media, whether it's broadcast or cable news networks or newspaper reports. But it seems we certainly are missing the deep down stories.
Yeah, I think so. Of course, this is very controversial, actually. Some people are really talking about shouldn't stay in Fukushima. Everybody should go away. But certainly, there are people who decided to stay there, and they told me they have been trying so hard to rebuild their life together. Nobody can say, really, at this point, nobody can say really safe or really not safe or what is right or what's wrong. But if people, there are the people, want to share their story with people in other countries, I thought, why not? I think I can do that part.
And come and give them a voice.
Yes.
And you do a lovely, lovely job telling the stories of the people who chose to stay. We hear from a former plant worker. You help us meet a musician who founded a little village near Fukushima in the 70s, and now he's the only resident there along with his wife. And then we meet a teacher and students of a middle school brass band and a taiko drum club. And the real thread throughout this film is their love and their commitment to the music. And that was really important to these
people. Very important. And interestingly, I never expected I'm going to collect lots of music when I started because I didn't know they are musician first. Mm-hmm. Of course, the brass band people and also Japanese drum group, mm-hmm. I knew they are musician. But other people, actually, I didn't know they play music. Mm-hmm. I asked some question. Everybody, equally asked the same question. One of them is, what your life joy? Mm-hmm. And they are expressing about music. And I thought, what? Wait a minute. Music, then the idea came later. Interestingly and also beautifully, everybody play music for this film.
So we saw many, many thousands of people leave. They were evacuated. People that you looked at in your film decided to stay. And one of the people in your film notes that the deeper theme of your film is less about the accident and more about living one's own life.
Yes.
How so?
I think no matter where you live, everybody has to is kind of weird, but everybody equally face difficulty mm-hmm. in life. Of course, their difficulty is unusual. Not everybody going to experience, but then I think it's a really life theme. Everybody has to go through the difficulty and then find their own happiness, their own peaceful peace in life. So I didn't really plan to make that the theme, but when I'm interacting with those people, most important part, and equally everybody expressed how we live fully, no matter what situation is.
Do you feel your film is hopeful?
Yes, I think so. I'm not saying Fukushima is safe, or this is the right way, or this is the wrong way, or should life live like this way, or anything like that. But then I think that's why I use a whisper, you know. It's nobody really make a statement or anything, but then whispering their truth, their real feeling, you know. And then we can sense that truth. I think that's very, to me, very important. And then I really hope each viewer to sense that whisper, sense from their music, and then think from there what we can do for a better future together.
The film is Threshold, Whispers of Fukushima, and it will be screened tonight, 7 o'clock, at the Helmut Stern Auditorium right there at the University of Michigan Museum of Art on South State Street in Ann Arbor. And we've been talking with filmmaker Toko Shiki, who we want to thank for coming in and joining us and speaking with us. And congratulations on your first full-length film.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. These have been pretty trying years for bookstores, for booksellers. iPads, Kindles, and other e-readers. Amazon and its books, those are a mouse click away. The big box stores that once posed such a threat to the small independent bookstore have been hit hard. Borders folded in 2011. Barnes & Noble has been forced to close hundreds of stores. But independent bookstores are proving to have staying power. The American Booksellers Association says indie bookstores have increased their numbers by more than 25% since 2009. Shops like Source Booksellers on Cass in Detroit. Janet Jones is the owner, and she has been selling books for 25 years. Janet, you've watched this entire cycle happen. And I'm wondering, when the likes of Borders and Barnes & Noble were on the rise pre-Amazon days, did you feel a hit then?
Well, I have to tell you that my bookselling has been in three, I call them evolutions, or three stages. I started by being a vendor, going to where people had books. And then I joined a collective of women businesses in the Spiral Collective for 10 and a half years. And then now I've moved across the street from there to the Spiral Collective, from the Spiral Collective to the Auburn building with my own bookstore, standalone bookstore. And I say all that because over the years I've been working in the book industry. I focused totally on the reader. The big places have had their day, and I'm always reminded that prior to the big books, big box stores, there were small independent bookstores.
There sure were.
And we knew bookstores because they were small, independent. They were often niche market bookstores. And so I think that we are refashioning ourselves one more time to assist and adapt to the customer who is looking for an experience with books and not just to do a quick, fast, and in a hurry buy because it's a popular thing to do for a moment. So everything has its cycles, and I think small independent bookstores, as the American Booksellers Association has said, have been growing by 27% since 2009. Now, I did read part of the stats from them that said 59 new bookstores opened in 2014 that joined the American Booksellers Association. That's not to say anything about those that haven't joined.
Sure, sure.
So there's a great resurgence, I think, in the interest in bookstores. And I think that's for several reasons. One is that people really like to meet up with each other. Mm. And for a long time, people have been meeting each other at coffee shops and bars before that and other kind of things. But bookstores are always a way that people would meet each other and have an opportunity to have conversation around topics of interest, around books, or just to meet up. They do it in grocery stores, too. So human beings like to meet up, and I think the bookstore is another one of those places where people can meet each other and talk about things together and share.
You know, it's interesting. As I think about e-readers, and a friend, here we are talking today, and this morning a friend of mine was sharing a story on Facebook. It was a Time magazine story from the United Kingdom, and the bookstores in the UK are saying there is more demand for, honest to God, physical books, and that they feel that the e-book growth has dramatically slowed and perhaps even gone into reverse. Do you think that? What's happening here? Do you think the novelty of e-readers is not what it was?
Well, I think that the statistics are telling us what we need to know here, because I was at a book trade show in October, and at that time we were told through the statistics that the use of the e-reader is flattening out. You see, when it came on the scene as a new gadget, as a new idea, as a new possibility and all that, everything like that always spikes up. And so people were interested. They wanted to find out about it. Curious human beings that we are,
sure.
We like to find out about that new thing and see how that works and if we can use it. And then after a while, it's going to slow down a little bit and find its place among the variety of tools and toys that we have to use. But I think that there's a loneliness to the e-reader that just doesn't occur when people have a physical book and are also connected with other people. I think there's been a rise in people's interest in books through book clubs. People want to join together and talk about books together. I think I just think that there's so much that people do, and I always say as the human beings do, because you can't predict that these human beings are going to do things in new and different ways, even though they are encouraged and marketed to very heavily by radio, by television, by newspapers, magazines that are online. You go online and you're just bombarded with all kinds of things to know about. But there's still an interest in seeking out for yourself books at a bookstore.
What do you hear from other booksellers in Michigan? Are they feeling pretty confident now? We've gone through the Great Recession, and are we looking ahead and feeling good?
Someone told me not long ago, whose business did go away after 40 years, but it was a bunch of things that made that happen, where they decided to close. But the person who had worked there for many, many years said to me, he said, "Janet, people really do want to read. They really want to read. What they read and how they read are always in question." So in my experience now has been that the print industry has just exploded with exciting new books, new ways of putting a book together. Books have CDs in them. They have fabulous pictures. They're all kinds of sizes now. I have a little happiness right now that I'm working on. I'm very attracted to little, small books, the kind you can put in your pocket or in your purse. They're small. And I have a number of them at the store, and they're coming out with a number of them because people are on the move. And sometimes they can take a little book with them and enjoy it in their as they go along. My theory is that when we have more public transportation where people are riding a public conveyor to get where they're going, the literacy rates in all these places will skyrocket. They'll just go up. Because if you've ever been anywhere where there is a public transportation that's used heavily, almost always you see people with something to read. Could be a newspaper, a magazine. It could even be a screen now, you know, a little portable phone type thing. Or it could be a book. But literacy rises in these places. And if you think about Boston, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, we all see them as more of a London, Paris. See these places as being more cultured, and, you know, there was little quotes around it, because people are reading a lot. So my theory is that the more public transportation we have, the greater the literacy rate will be. But
that's interesting.
My
so someone's thinking of opening a small bookstore. Janet, biggest do and biggest don't?
Well, I think that if somebody wants to do that, of course they have to do all of their preparatory work, you know, thinking about who their clientele will be, where will they be located, what is it that they really want to offer to the public, which is what we do. If we're a public business, then we have said to the state, we have something that we want to offer to the public in general. And so they've got to do that kind of work. But I say go do it. because, as the gentleman told me, people really do want to read. And if we have a passion for reading, which I think people do, or passion for information and knowledge and understanding, then bookstores are another wonderful and tried and true vehicle for that. I like to say that bookstores add another texture to a community. We have lots of restaurants. We have fast food places. We have clothing stores, which I have nothing wrong with, you know, all of those things. But when you add a bookstore into a community, you're adding another kind of texture on interest and a destination for people to go to.
Janet Jones, the owner of Source Booksellers on Cass and Canfield in Detroit's Midtown, has been selling books for 25 years and going strong. Janet, thank you so much for talking to us about the small independent bookstore.
Thank you so much. And yes, let's have more bookstores. Thank you so much.
This is Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Love that. Delicious.
Enjoy.
When it comes to wine, do you go with the cork or the screw cap? Our Detroit Magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic, Chris Cook, has been thinking about this question.
About 10 years ago, the occupationally snooty world of wine was introduced to the radical idea of putting screw caps on fine wine. In 2004, a study found that more than half American consumers and 60% of British wine drinkers rejected the idea of a screw cap. But inside the world of wine, there was a big problem, and screw caps offered potentially a big solution. Depending on who's counting, about 4 to 6% of fine table wines finished with the old-fashioned cork were coming off spoiled and not drinkable. One reason? Corks leak air, and air oxidizes the wine. A new kind of leak-proof screw cap called the Stelvin closure, being tested by Australian and New Zealand wineries, was cutting that spoilage rate in half. The design of the Stelvin forms a tight air seal to keep out oxygen, and that's a big benefit in maintaining the wine's overall quality and aging. The Stelvin, it appeared, could save the wineries millions of dollars. The second advantage was that the screw cap also eliminated another problem called cork taint, a chemical leaching that occurs randomly and gives wine a musty smell and changes how it tastes. It turns out that as far back as the 1970s, the vaunted French wine house Chateau Aubryon in Bordeaux had quietly experimented with screw caps, putting 100 bottles under long-term observation to see what would happen. Aubryon's manager, Jean-Bernard Delmas, reported, "It worked perfectly for the first 10 years, until plastic caps went brittle and let in the air." In another screw cap experiment, a researcher found off odors such as rotten eggs. But the unanswered question remains, was it the screw cap, or was it something in the wine itself? Today, the use of screw caps continues to increase, but with some clear delineations. Younger white and red wines, those consumed in less than 5 years, are being sold with screw caps. But for consumers spending $30 and up, well, no worries. The romance of twisting the wine key into that staid old cork and the pop sound of pulling it out is not likely to disappear anytime soon. The big-name wineries are holding fast with the cork.
That was Chris Cook, our Detroit Magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic. Still to come.
What may seem inappropriate or harassment is really not when you understand what the law enforcement side of things goes through.
That is coming up next. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Peaceful protests continue in Madison, Wisconsin, after an unarmed black teenager was killed by a white police officer Friday night. It's the latest conflict between police and the communities they protect. And it's something that the Michigan Department of Civil Rights hopes to keep from happening here in Michigan. The MDCR is working all around the state with something called ALPACT. It stands for Advocates and Leaders for Police and Community Trust. Matt Wiesaw is executive director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, and he knows the situation from the police officer's side. Matt was a Michigan state trooper for 26 years. Welcome, Matt.
It's good to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, these troubles in Ferguson, Missouri, or Hammond, Indiana, or now most recently in Madison, Wisconsin, have truly placed this issue of community and police relations onto the nation's front burner. But ALPACT has been looking at this since way before these headlines, hasn't it?
Yes. I think Michigan is well above the curve. We started the first ALPACT about 18 years ago in the city of Detroit. That began as a result of a complaint from the citizens of Detroit thinking they were being improperly profiled by the law enforcement community in Detroit. You had your African-American community and the Arab-American community, as well as others, thinking they were being inappropriately stopped and harassed. As a result of that, the decision was made involving the U.S. attorney, other high-level law enforcement folks, government leaders, faith-based leaders, community leaders, to sit down at the table and talk about what is the responsibility in the process that everyone does their job. Basically, it was to develop better lines of communication and also gain an understanding of, on the law enforcement side, why we do what we do and how we do it. And what may seem inappropriate or harassment is really not when you understand what the law enforcement side of things goes through. That has turned out to be just extremely beneficial. And when you look at the communities now where things are not going so well, let's talk about Ferguson for a second. There is absolutely zero trust there and also zero communication. And when you look at the Department of Justice's report that just came out and then the president's community policing report that came out, his task force number one recommendation was to meet and create trust and communication. So I think that just speaks to Michigan being well ahead of the curve.
And how many ALPACTs do we have in Michigan?
We have five, Detroit being the first. We also have Saginaw, Flint, Benton Harbor, and Grand Rapids.
And can you look at any things that have happened in those communities and say, yes, because we had the ALPAC, this didn't blow up?
There are two relatively recent ones. You had the incident in Dearborn, which is part of the Detroit ALPAC, where the African-American young female was shot through the door. And there was civil unrest ready to begin. The community activists were really enraged at what happened. There was minimal communication coming out because of a relationship that had been developed by Captain Jerome Solomon of the Dearborn Police Department and a very high-profile activist. They sat down and were able to discuss the situation. And the captain said, you know, just give us a day, 2 days to get our evidence together. I'll let you know what's going on, and then we'll go from there. And the activists allowed that. And I think everybody knows now an investigation was conducted, a warrant was issued, and the man was convicted. The civil unrest, the destruction of relationships, and quite honestly, community property was averted. You had a similar situation in Saginaw where a homeless man was killed by members of the Saginaw Police Department. First, the prosecutor, then the Department of Justice came down and did not find that the police officer acted inappropriately. That created a lot of bad feelings in the community, but I will give U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District, Barb McQuaid, a lot of credit. She got out in front of that, called members of the ALPAC up there and said, okay, guys, we need to sit down and talk. Things are going to happen, and I want you to know why they happened. Here's the process that we went through. Here's the evidence that I can share with you, and here is going to be the results of what comes out. Again, people weren't necessarily happy because, you know, they obviously wanted a different type of action. But through that trust that was built up, through the communication, a lot of community unrest also was averted. That in turn spurred more communication, more work that has to be done. But it's work that's being done now together as a community instead of, you know, an us against them kind of thing.
Well, as you describe these things, Matt, I'm remembering the Malice Green death in Detroit. And for those who aren't familiar, who weren't in Michigan at the time, this was a man on the street and a couple of white Detroit officers wanted him to open his hand. He didn't. And mag flashlights came out and he was beaten to death. And ultimately, those officers were convicted.
Yes, ma'am.
But there was a lot of unrest.
Yes, there was.
It was the whole Ferguson thing you kind of remember. I remember being down at that unrest and covering that as a reporter, and it was not a good time in Detroit's history.
No. And that was pre-ALPACT by a few years. But I think that, you know, that's just one of those things that shows nobody operates in a vacuum. You know, I often tell anybody and everybody that I work with, when an issue develops, when you drill down to it, you're going to find that it's the lack of communication. Either you're not communicating or somebody's not understanding what you're trying to communicate, or you're not saying it in a way that they can understand. But it boils down to having conversation, being able to sit in the same room with people that you are going to have to agree to just disagree at times. But you still should be able to have that conversation so you know where you're coming from. Everybody has a job to do, whether it's law enforcement or an activist, you know, in their position of protecting their community. Mm-hmm. But it boils down to communication.
Now, the ALPAC meetings aren't public. Is that important to the process?
Yes, you know, because you want a segment of each of the different groups there. You know, you want the law enforcement folks there. You want the political folks there. You want the faith-based people there. You want the community watch people there, the neighborhood association people mm-hmm. there, the business people there. You want everybody there that's going to come into contact with law enforcement, which quite honestly is everybody. And, you know, you share information on, you know, how things are taking place. You sometimes have the ability, knowing that something's coming down the pike, to say, okay, guys, this is, you know, we're about 2 weeks away from this happening. Here's what we're looking at. You know, let's maintain our open lines of communication so we don't go off kilter when this happens. The one piece that, in my opinion, that I think we miss at those meetings on a regular basis is the media folks. The media plays such an important part in this whole process. And I don't know if there's a correct answer in how we get them to the table, because they have a role to play, which is a little bit different than the role that everybody else plays.
What do you see that role being?
Well, what I see it being is getting out the most accurate information that they can, but that's not how they operate. The media is to get information out quickly, and they're going to normally go with the first information they get, which sometimes isn't always the most accurate. But yet that sets the wheels in motion. And then the other folks have to come back and kind of get everybody back on track. So that's not to say there's fault. It's to say that how do we figure out how to get everybody at the table at the same time working for the same goal, which is basically to keep our community safe.
As you look at the way that ALPACs are working in Michigan, looking ahead to building more bridges, what kind of dialogue needs to happen and understanding on the part of law enforcement and then the other side of the coin as well with the community? What does each side need to understand and do?
On the law enforcement side, we need to have a stronger effort in understanding cultural diversity. Michigan is just a melting pot of different cultures. While we are probably training the most highly trained law enforcement officer now in this state than we've ever trained before, you have a bit of a difference. And again, this is a Matt Wiesaw opinion. Mm-hmm. You've got Detroit Police Department and the Michigan State Police, which have their own academies. The other training centers are at community colleges or four-year colleges. So they're academia. So if, you know, small town Michigan wants to hire a couple police officers, they go through an academy. They graduate from that academy. They go to that police department. So you've got this A1 training, and you're going to a police department that maybe isn't as up to speed on cultural diversity as everybody else. That's kind of an example. I started in 1975. One of my first few days out, I was riding with a senior officer, and we do that from 6 to 9 months. You ride two-man because there's on-the-job training as well as your academy training. And I performed what I call a textbook traffic stop. And as soon as we were done, I got chewed out. You don't ever put me in a situation like that again. And I said, well, wait a second. I did what I was trained to do. That's not how we do it out here. So you have that. You're trained in the academy, and then this is how we do it out here. And if you think about it, Chief Craig from Detroit PD mm-hmm. just did an interview, and he relayed a story about his first day on the job, where he was told by his 25-year veteran white officer, you don't belong here. Just sit there. Be quiet. Act black. I think that was a quote. So what we're missing, in my opinion, is how do we get the cultural diversity, the understanding of the unconscious bias of the older management of police departments, and even the older management of the political entities that hire the police chiefs, to understand that there is that unconscious bias there. And quite honestly, maybe a conscious bias.
We saw that in Ferguson when we saw the emails and the jokes
clearly.
That were clearly on the wrong side of that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Quite honestly, I don't know how you fix that. I read the two reports, and I'm thinking to myself, how are these people keeping their jobs? You know, you're talking about numerous constitutional violations, just a terrible culture. I recognize the Department of Justice said, you know, we need to start the interaction between the law enforcement community and the residents. I quite frankly don't know how you do that.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
But here in Michigan, because it's been recognized, these ALPACs have been meeting since the mid-90s, that, as you say, we are ahead of the curve. God forbid, we have a headline like happened over the weekend in Madison, but we know it can happen. Do you feel that the state is ready?
Well, I won't say that we're ready. I would like to think that we're in a position where the odds of that occurring in this state are a little less than the others. Now, should a serious incident like that happen, I do think we're prepared for it because we have those relationships.
The line of communication and trust in being built.
I mean, shortly after Ferguson happened, the comment was being made by different folks, you know, Detroit is the next Ferguson. Well, quite honestly, that was – I happened to sit on a committee with Chief Craig. He was offended by that comment. And many others in the law enforcement community, the director of the state police, Colonel Etchew, was offended by that comment because they all, along with many other law enforcement leaders, work very hard so that those things don't happen. And I think if a situation would occur, well, for example, you've got Saginaw and Dearborn. Those were averted. I think, you know, we're making sure that larger cities, other folks that are interested know that the resources of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights are there to help them create these ALPACs. We don't go in and run them. You know, we show them the framework from which they work and which they've been successful. Most of the ALPACs have two co-chairs, one being a law enforcement official and one being a non-law enforcement official, so you don't have one group running the show. And that just works better. Some of the other benefits of having the ALPAC is as you sit there and discuss the different needs or shortfalls that are recognized, then we can talk with the folks at MCOLS, the Michigan Commission on Law Enforcement Standards, who set the standard for licensing law enforcement officers. We can say, hey, we need, you know, more of this kind of training. And quite honestly, that's how cultural diversity training got implemented. That's not anything that's been there for too many years. Matter of fact, there was just a meeting Friday at the Ingham County Sheriff's Department with many MCOLs and other outside law enforcement agencies where we came in and discussed that. Do we need to enhance, update, expand the training that's done in the academies now to make sure that there is an understanding of not only cultural diversity, but the unconscious bias? And again, I started in 75. There's guys that I started with that are still working. So how do you get to those folks if they need that, if they don't recognize that unconscious bias? Which I'll be honest, the first time that was brought to my attention, I had never considered that. But it's there. You instinctively have a bias, you know, right out of the gate, quickly, you know, it goes away, and you look at the person. But it's, you know, it's something that we have to recognize is there.
But it has to be a pretty good feeling to look at that president's report and go, you know what, we're ahead of it.
Yes.
We've been on it. Matt Wiesod, Executive Director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you again for the invitation. Anytime, we're glad to help out. And this state is going to be a better state to live, work, and play.
This year will mark the 17th season for the Great Lakes Cruise Company, bringing tourists and their money to the Great Lakes. This year we'll see three new cruises between Chicago and Montreal, along with a new ship, the Saint Laurent. Chris Conlon is president of the Great Lakes Cruise Company. Chris, you've added this fourth ship, the Saint Laurent. You have boosted the number of cruises on the Great Lakes in the Northeast to 22. So there are enough people willing to cruise the lakes?
That's right. It's hard probably for most listeners here to imagine cruising on the Great Lakes. We've grown up around them. I've grown up around them. I think, wow, I don't need to be on a ship.
Yeah.
And how can a ship even come into the Great Lakes? Well, it's a completely different experience to be out there on the water. So what we're trying to bring to people in that itinerary is the history of the Great Lakes, the cultural aspects of the Great Lakes, the geography and geology, and we have enrichment speakers aboard to talk about that. And then as we choose our ports of call, embarkation, disembarkation, Montreal, Chicago, sometimes it's Toronto to Chicago, oftentimes we've used Duluth. So we're looking at, obviously, the far points of the Great Lakes, and then what is going to be most exciting to people about a cruise. And frankly, majority of our customers aren't from the Midwest. They are California, Florida, Texas. They might have roots in the Midwest, but they're looking for a new itinerary that's close to home, easy to get to, safe, and it's going to have nice accommodations while they cruise the Great Lakes.
Now, I'm interested, what do you do to strike the balance between bringing visitors into the Great Lakes and protecting them and keeping them unsullied?
Great question, because we all know about the zebra mussels and how they got here through ballast.
Yes.
Saltwater ballast. Well, these ships don't have that. So there's obviously there's a heightened awareness of that. Along the way, the ports of call, we have refuge disposal and pickup. We get provisioned at certain ports of call, but there's no wastewater going back into our Great Lakes, not in the cruise ships.
What do you hope that people who take these cruises will take away from their impressions of the Great Lakes?
Really good question. First of all, the audience is a senior audience. This is not necessarily a family trip because the ships are smaller. There aren't as many activities. There isn't a casino aboard. It wouldn't be allowed even if it would have to be closed if it were aboard. But what people are taking back is that enrichment. It is an educational trip. The destination is not the ship, like so many of the cruises might be, with 5,000 people aboard and water slides and ice skating rinks. That's not the concept. The concept here is to learn more about our nation's history, learn more about the formation of the Great Lakes and what role and importance they had in the formation of our nation.
And I would suspect if you have a Michiganders who say, all right, I'm going to make this a vacation, they are probably getting a chance to see their state with new eyes.
They are. It's a tough sell to Michiganders, as what I told you before,
because I paddled in that lake.
It's right over there. There's the lake. How come I'm not going to do that? But it is so eye-opening. And we've taken many, many Michiganders aboard some of the cruises, and they have just such fond memories.
So what are your future hopes for expanding the Great Lakes Cruise Company?
Well, there are only so many ships that can make it into the market. But the niche market, the markets that are kind of off the radar screen, are really increasing in popularity because the world is so small. Cruise ships have been just about everywhere they can go. We now have, there's a lot of Downton Abbey fans out there. Mm-hmm. You see Viking River Cruises advertise. Well, they're coming to New Orleans. They're starting a Mississippi type. So they're looking for new destinations. So we'll only be able to see more ships come in the market as the economy improves and as cruise lines look for new markets to venture into.
Chris Conlon is the president of the Great Lakes Cruise Company, which is a division of Conlon Travel of Ann Arbor. Good to talk with you, Chris. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.